Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and once again we're live for an hour with an open phone line for you if you want to call in with questions about the Bible or the Christian faith that are on your mind. Or if you have a different viewpoint from the host and want to call in and talk about that, you're always welcome to do so. The number to call is 844-484-5737. Now, as I look at the phone lines, it looks like they may all be full right now, so I'm just giving you a warning. If you call at this moment, you might find a busy signal. But if you do, keep this number ready and call in a few minutes. We'll probably have a line opening up. The number is 844-484-5737. One announcement about tonight. If you live in or near Southern California and want to join us for an open Q&A meeting in Temecula, we only do this once a month on a Friday night. It used to be on a Saturday night. The church we use had ceased to be available on Saturday, but made it available on Friday. This is a bit of an issue because on Friday nights, there's a lot of traffic on I-15 between San Diego and Corona especially, and we're between there. So people might not want to come out because of getting stuck in traffic. That was not a problem so much on Saturday nights. It's an issue on Friday. However, we have made the meeting later than it used to be. It's now 7:30, which means that many of you could come because the traffic would be dying down a little later in the evening. So the meeting is at 7:30. We meet at the Love of Christ Fellowship. If you don't know where that is, it's a little tiny place. You can find the address and such at our website, thenarrowpath.com. It's an open Q&A for the public. I hope you'll join us if you can. Go to thenarrowpath.com, check the tab that says announcements, you'll find it, and join us if you're free. It'll be a good time of fellowship, if nothing else. And it will be something else, too. It'll be a time of questions and answers. So that's tonight at 7:30 in Temecula. All right, our lines are, in fact, full, so we'll go to the phones directly and talk to Brandon from Hillsboro, Oregon. Brandon, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Hi. Great to talk to you.
Thank you.
So we have a wedding coming up in our family, and my future son-in-law is trying to navigate the topic of who we do and don't associate with. So we have a couple sisters who we'd like to be bridesmaids. I don't think if I were to ask them, they'd profess to be Christian right now.
Uh-huh.
They're currently both shacking up, and maybe some other things that they shouldn't be doing. Irresponsible teenagers, stuff they go through. Yeah. and we're just not sure how this is supposed to be applied or not. And, of course, whenever you talk about not including someone in a wedding, there's lots of people who have a very emotional opinion on it. But He's just trying to do what God requires of him, and we're trying to make sure we understand what's required correctly.
Well, I'm sure he's concerned about what Paul said about if anyone claims to be a brother and is a fornicator, then don't even eat with such a person. I would say that statement probably needs to be understood in terms of table fellowship in the church, because the church met around a table and had a communal meal, as we see later in the same book. Paul said that in 1 Corinthians 5, but later in chapter 11, he talked about at the table where people were taking the Lord's Supper. It was an actual meal where some were eating too much and drinking too much, so that some people went home hungry and some went home drunk. And so it's obvious that the fellowship of the church was around a table. And that was true, of course, in the early church as well, not only in Corinthians. Now, when Paul says, you know, if somebody claims to be a brother and is living in an immoral life, don't eat with such a person, I think that's in the context of church fellowship. I don't think it has to do with family relations. I don't think that that's forbidding, for example, if you have an uncle who goes to church and is living with his girlfriend, that you shouldn't have him over for Thanksgiving meal with the family. I mean, that's not the same thing as fellowship. I think that Paul's concerned about families obviously are divided in many cases in their loyalties, and I don't think Paul intended for families to be broken up over those things. Now, the two girls you mentioned, I think they're two, you said you don't think they claim to be Christians, which means the fact that they don't live as Christians should not be as much of an issue in this case. Now, if obviously parents and loved ones of those girls would still be concerned about them. But in terms of whether it's okay to invite them to a Christian wedding, even though they're immoral in their lifestyles, the fact that they wouldn't necessarily claim to be Christians means that there's no reason to disassociate them. Paul, like
now, would
you said,
that change if we were to talk to them and I think one wouldn't even pretend, but one might give the answer of, oh, yes, yes, because she's probably struggling, and yeah, she knows that's the answer that people would want to hear. Yeah. Does that change things? Now, maybe being family, it doesn't, like you mentioned.
Right. Because it's a family situation, I don't know that I would make an issue of it. I mean, having her stand with bridesmaids isn't the same thing as having necessarily a time of fellowship with her. But of course, who's invited to participate in the wedding, either as guests or as, the wedding party or whatever, I think should go, according to the convictions of the bride and the groom, and of course the parents of the bride and the groom who are usually putting on the wedding. But I would think if the groom himself says, I don't feel comfortable with this, well then, you know, his wishes should be honored, although if he's being unwise and perhaps causing a rift in the future relationships in the family by doing so, perhaps he could be talked out of it. My thought is if it's just a matter of being conscientious and saying, well, I don't think we're supposed to associate with fornicators. Paul specifically said if they're not Christians, then we shouldn't have any problem associating with them, even though they're fornicators, because they're not claiming to be anything else than what they are. Now,
it could be causing him some additional grief, as he believes in once saved, always saved. And so maybe there's some issue there with at least one of them for sure has claimed to be a Christian before and probably not professing currently.
Yeah. Well, even if you believe in once saved, always saved, that doesn't mean that someone who once professed to be a Christian was one. In other words, lots of people, Jesus said, will say, we did all these things, and he'll say, I never knew you. So there are people who profess to be Christians, and they aren't. So you can't assume that somebody who professed to be a Christian when she was young and now doesn't live as a Christian or claim to be a Christian, you can't necessarily assume that she really was a Christian, ever. And if she wasn't, then once saved, always saved doesn't even apply. Now, I don't even believe in once saved, always saved, but the point is, if he does, I would ask him,
right,
what makes you think she ever was a Christian? You know, when a person makes some kind of a verbal assent, especially when they're young and under the influence of their family and so forth, who are Christians, but then when they have the freedom to live the life they want, they usually show the nature of that commitment. You know, if they had a real commitment, they follow Christ into their teenage years. If they don't have a real commitment, then they don't. I think, in a sense, teenage years are a perfect way to tell whether a child's youthful profession of faith had any validity or not. Anyway, it's a complicated thing, but my thought is, and I do have a lot of callers waiting, but I would say that he should realize that a wedding is not exactly the same thing as a church fellowship, though I do think, ideally, a wedding should be a matter of the Christian community that the person's a part of. But if there's even so much as one unbeliever invited, and I don't know if there's any unbelievers invited to the wedding.
I'm sure there is.
Yeah, then it would seem clear this is not intended as a Christian fellowship, but just as a ceremony. And I wouldn't think that the rules that apply to, fellowshipping with someone in the church necessarily have to apply to a ceremony, which may just as a matter of course happen in a church building. That doesn't make
all
a
right
fellowship of the church.
Thank you so much for your time. I
okay, Brandon, thank you for your call. I'm sorry for the conflict in the family there. Many families find that weddings are a very difficult time to keep peace, especially nowadays where there's so many different views of marriage out there. And some weddings definitely go against the convictions. For example, not only a same-sex marriage, but also a marriage where somebody has been divorced wrongfully and is getting remarried in a situation that Jesus would call adultery. A lot of times, a situation that would cause similar conflicts in a family. It'd be nice if everyone just followed Jesus. Then there wouldn't be any of these problems. But obviously, that's a voluntary issue, and not everyone volunteers for it. Jeff from San Francisco, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Steve. How are
Hi,
you
Jeff.
Doing?
Good.
We had a good week. Steve, I wanted to ask you, do you always have on the full armor?
Well, I hope so. I mean, what is the full armor of God? It's the breastplate of righteousness. I'm trusting Christ, and he's my righteousness. I have the helmet of salvation. I don't generally take that off at night when I go to bed. You know, I have the belt of truth, the shield of faith. I mean, these are things that this is just what you wear as a Christian. It's actually, the Bible makes it clear that it's Jesus that's wearing the armor. If you look in Isaiah, it says that Jesus put on the helmet of salvation and the breastplate of righteousness. And putting on the armor, if you look at the last three verses of Romans 13, Paul says that putting on the armor is putting on the Lord Jesus Christ. So as you put on Christ, he's wearing the armor, and therefore in him you have the armor. So in him you are righteous. In him you have, you know, the truth, you have salvation, and so forth. And so, yeah, I think a Christian, as long as they're abiding in Christ, has the armor of God. Now, whether they count on it and use it effectively in the spiritual conflicts with the enemy, that's maybe another issue. But the armor of God comes with the package of being in Christ.
Hmm. Okay. To ask you real quick, are you going to be in Southern California next month?
Yeah, certainly part of it.
Okay. And I plan to go there, so
all right. Well,
neat.
Look me up.
Steve, I want to ask you a question that has to do with peace, world peace. Throughout time, mankind has always failed to establish a world peace, a lasting real world peace. And why is that? Is it simply because, you know, his fallen nature?
Well, yeah, I mean, Isaiah says twice, there's no peace for the wicked. Now, the wicked, not every human being is wicked, although all people are sinners, but wicked is a pretty strong term. Not everyone's wicked, but enough people are to prevent peace from being universal. There's enough people who really don't want peace. Remember, it says in the psalm, I am for peace, but when I speak, they are for war. The psalmist says, I've dwelt too long among those who hate peace. I am for peace, but when I speak, they're for war. There's people who just don't want peace. They want to fight. And one reason is because they're insecure, or they're hateful, or they're greedy, or something else. I mean, James said, from whence come wars and fightings among you? Do they not come from here, from your lusts that war in your members? You desire to have and cannot obtain. You fight and war to obtain it. And so, you know, the war, it comes from sinful attitudes which people do not check and do not repent of. So greed, the coveting what somebody else has, a hatred, the desire for revenge, the desire for mere power. I mean, all of these are very wicked motives, and yet they dwell in too many hearts. And especially, it's interesting how many wicked people aspire for power in governments. And once they get there, and a great number of them do, I really think there's a higher density of wicked people in governments than there are in the general population. I think the average neighbor on my block, I don't know if any of them are what I call really wicked. I mean, a lot of them are sinners, but truly wicked, malicious people. I don't know that, I'm not sure if any of them are. But I don't know if you'd walk through the halls of Congress and find, you know, 2 out of 5 that aren't. You know, I may be too, cynical, but it does seem there's an awful lot of compromising characters in the government. And so it's governments that declare war. And so you'd very typically find people with those kinds of bad motivations are also in the position to engage their nations against other nations in war. And that's one reason why I believe there's not been peace. All right, I thank you for your call. Let's talk to Teo from Seattle, Washington. Teo, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hello. It's good to talk to you again. I think you remember me. We met a while ago when you came here to Romanian Church.
Okay, yeah.
Two quick questions. I'm trying to get your opinion and only a few verses if you can. We had a Bible study, and the idea came about Jesus when he was tempted, and knowing that Hebrews 5:7, it says that, you know, he was crying out to his father to be delivered from death. So the question was, could Jesus, you know, fail? Could Jesus sin, or was it impossible for him, knowing that he was second Adam, he has to identify like us,
yeah.
He was tempted like us in all things, but of course without sin. The question was, we all agree that he overcame all the temptation, but could he fail, or was it impossible?
The doctrine of the impeccability of Christ, as it's so called, is that Jesus could not sin because he was God. And this doctrine is held by theologians who are of usually considered to be of, you know, Orthodox evangelical theologians, believe that Jesus could never have sinned because he was God, and God cannot sin. I don't find this to be necessarily biblical. Of course, Jesus is God, and of course, God can't sin. But God can't die either, and Jesus did die. God can't be tempted, and Jesus was tempted. God can't become weary and slumber and sleep, but Jesus did. God, there's a lot of things about God that weren't true of Jesus, because Jesus was not only God, he was also a man. And becoming a man means that he took on certain handicaps that God does not normally have. God becoming a man was a unique historical event. It never happened before and won't happen again. And it involved something rather amazing, and that is that God had to trim himself down to human size and live in human weakness in the likeness of sin.
He was like us, more than just the body. That's what someone's saying. Only in the body became man, but he was, you know, from
right. He wasn't just God putting on a human shell. He's God taking on human nature. That's what it means that he was descended from Adam and Abraham and David and through Mary and so forth. If God just wants to take on a human shell, well, he's done that in the Old Testament. There's what we call theophanies, where God appears to Jacob or to Abraham in a physical human body. But he doesn't have human nature. He's God. He's God taking on a human shape. That's not what Jesus is. Jesus isn't just God taking on a shell that looks like a human being, but he's God taking on humanity, becoming part of humanity. And that humanity includes, not necessarily that he had to sin, but that he would have to be subject to those temptations that lead men to sin. And there's no, just like he was subject to death and tiredness and other things, that God is not usually subject to. I believe he is subject to vulnerability, to temptation. But he didn't succumb.
The idea came from Jacob, and we are tempted because of our lust. Did Jesus have any wrong lust? No, because he had no sin in him, you know.
Well, what constitutes a wrong lust? Let me just examine that. The word lust, we think of lust as an evil thing. The word lust in the Bible just translates a Greek word that means desire. It's really just an older English word for desire, and the Greek word means desire. Now, this word can be used of desires that are wrong and of desires that are right. Sometimes a desire is neutral, but it can incline toward wrong or right in different situations. For example, a man who has sexual desire, if that desire is toward his wife, that's right. If that desire is toward somebody who's not his wife, that's not right. A person might have a desire, might be hungry and have a desire to eat. Well, if he's eating food that's lawfully his to eat, then that's fine. If he's supposed to be fasting, then he shouldn't eat. Or if he's, you know, if he's tempted to steal somebody else's food, then that's a bad desire. See, the desire to eat, the desire to sleep, the desire to have sex, the desire to, you know, have, you know, security and things like that. Those are desires that can be used in a way that's quite agreeable with God's laws, or the same desires can lead us into breaking God's laws. Now, when our desires lead us into breaking God's laws, that's a temptation, and it becomes a sin. Jesus had human hormones. He had glands. He had human chemistry. He would have had natural human interest in the opposite sex. He would have had, we know he got hungry. We know he got thirsty. We know he got tired. These, you know, the desire for sleep, that can be a good thing, unless you're a sentry, and then your desire for sleep is a temptation. And so desire that's human is not necessarily good or evil until it is directed towards something and that something is good or evil. So, again, the same kind of desire that makes me desire to eat a good meal at home might tempt me when I'm hungry and away from home to want to eat food that I can't afford to buy. But that would be stealing, and that'd be wrong. So desire, which is what the word lust means, is not in itself wrong. In fact, Jesus used the very same word in Luke chapter 21 or 22, I guess it's 22, when he said to the disciples, "With great desire I have desired to eat this Passover with you before I suffer." He's talking about his desire to take the Last Supper with the disciples. The word desire is the same one as lust, I mean, elsewhere in Scripture. Because desire is not bad, but it can be.
Jesus meant the bad desires that is getting us to sin. That's why we're tempted.
Right.
That's what I thought. That wouldn't make sense, Hebrews 5:7, because I don't think Jesus was afraid of physical death. He was talking about the death over there, about the comes after sinning, right? The separation resulting in sinning. That's why he was crying out to be delivered, right? He's our example. We have to do the same. Likewise.
Yeah, the whole ordeal that Jesus went through included the pain and suffering and physical death, but it was not excluded to that. It was, of course, a whole issue that arose between, you know, how he was atoning for sin and his alienation momentarily from God, I believe, and things like that. So,
cry was not just about when he was in Gethsemane. It was about throughout his life, it says over there. During his life on the earth, it was not about, you know, the physical death that he was about to approach before Calvary, right?
I think it was the whole ordeal. Yeah, which is more than just physical death, but included that. I mean,
Anyone would
wish to avoid being nailed to a cross. But even though he desired to avoid it, he said, "Not my will, but yours be done." See, that's exactly how temptation is defeated. Temptation exists when we have a desire for something that's different than God's desire, and when we surrender that to what God wants. So Jesus said, "If it's possible, deliver me from this." But he said, "But not my will, but yours be done." So, you know, James said, everyone is tempted when he's drawn away by his own desires and enticed. Obviously, if he's enticed to do the wrong thing and he's drawn away by his own desires to do the wrong thing, that's temptation. But if you are being drawn away to do the wrong thing, you can still say, "No, it's not what I want that's going to prevail here. It's what God wants, and God doesn't want me to do this." So that's taking charge over your desires and not letting them lead you into sin. And that's what Jesus did. That's how he handled temptation. I appreciate your call. Victor from Seattle, Washington, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Steve. I'll take this off the air. Just wanted to ask about being yoked with unbelievers. I know that generally pastors will talk about it from a marriage standpoint, but what's your point of view from doing business, partnership, and other aspects of that in terms of yoking with unbelievers? Thank you, Steve.
All right. Thank you for your call. Well, yeah, in the context of 2 Corinthians 6, where Paul talks about not being yoked together with unbelievers, he doesn't specify marriage as his intended subject, although certainly marriage would be a form of being yoked together with another person. There might be other forms of being yoked together, and as you say, business. Now, there's no reason why we shouldn't do business with unbelievers, but being yoked together with unbelievers would suggest being bound in some kind of a commitment, maybe a partnership in business, where the other person has as much to say about how the business is run as you do. And you might want to run the business by Christian principles, and the other person doesn't. That becomes a problem because you're bound in a partnership with them that makes it necessary for you to compromise and let that person make some of the decisions, maybe along lines that you wouldn't want to be made. It applies to marriage too, of course, because you're bound in a contract with your spouse, and if they're not a believer, they're going to want to have something to say about family policy, about child raising, about things like that, about how money is spent. And if they're not a believer, you've got to pretty much accommodate them in some measure, which makes it very difficult. So I think that Paul is generally talking about any situation where you are bound. Like an ox under a yoke with another ox is bound to that ox. the other ox might be lazy and want to lie down, and the one on the right wants to work. But the one that wants to lay down is going to hold back the one that wants to work, because they're stuck with this yoke over their neck. They're bound to each other in a way that neither of them can escape. Marriage is like that. Business partnerships are like that. There may be other circumstances that are like that as well. So I would agree with you, at least with what I think you're suggesting, and that is that being unequally yoked together would not only apply to marriage to an unbeliever, but would also apply to other situations that would be similarly a bondage, where you're stuck with somebody and they have as much pull as you do in a situation, but they don't have your values. A good question. I appreciate your call. We have to take a break at this point. A few stations leave our network at this point in time, and yet we do go on for another half hour, and most of our stations carry the whole hour. If yours doesn't, you can go to the website, thenarrowpath.com, and you can hear the whole program there, or you can get the mobile app, which is free for your iPhone or your Android, thenarrowpath.com, and you can hear the whole program from there. For those of you who are staying, we'll be right back after a few seconds. We are a listener-supported ministry. If you'd like to help us stay on the air, you can go to thenarrowpath.com and look for the Donate tab and find out how to help us pay the radio bills. If you could stay with us, do for the next 30 seconds, and we'll be right back.
Small is the gate and narrow is the path that leads to life. Welcome to The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. Steve has nothing to sell you today, but everything to give you. When the radio show is over, go to thenarrowpath.com where you can study, learn, and enjoy with free topical audio teachings, blog articles, verse-by-verse teachings, and archives of all The Narrow Path radio shows. We thank you for supporting the listener-supported Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. See you at thenarrowpath.com.
Welcome back to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we are live still for another half hour taking your calls. If you'd like to be on the program, you might have a question about the Bible or the Christian faith you'd like to bring up. You might have a different viewpoint from the host you'd like to bring up. Feel free to do so. The number to call to do that is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. And we're going back to the phones directly and talking to Dee from Daly City, California. Dee, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. You're welcome. God bless you. I got a couple questions. Would Jesus be considered, and also like the early church, like in the church like described in the Bible, would that be kind of considered like communist?
Well, they did practice
communism.
They did practice a voluntary sharing of goods, which is not very much
right.
Like communism, because communism is a governmental system that confiscates people's goods and redistributes them, which means communism is not voluntary. Now, the early church, this is a very good question, because there's a lot of people I'm talking to lately who talk about certain, you know, government policies in America. And they say, well, shouldn't, as Christians, shouldn't we want America to do this or that or this other thing? And what they're suggesting is something that involves personal sacrifice, personal endangerment out of love for other people. And, of course, God calls upon us to take personal risks, even endanger ourselves and make sacrifices out of love for other people. But we can't expect non-believers to do that. And a secular nation can't legislate those things. Because once they're legislated, they're not done out of love anymore. They're done out of coercion, out of force, out of fear of punishment. And that spoils everything. You know, Christopher Hitchens said religion poisons everything. In a sense, government poisons everything when it comes to doing righteous deeds. Because governments can and should make laws that enforce justice. But when it comes to mercy, you can't enforce mercy. As soon as somebody is forced to be merciful, they're not being merciful. Mercy comes from the heart. Now, when there's a community of people voluntarily following Jesus Christ, which is what the church is, and Jesus says, I want you to love your neighbor as you love yourself. And that community then says, well, some of us have more than others. And those of us who do want to help those who don't, because we love our neighbors, we love ourselves. So I, who have some extra, I think I'll sell what I have that's extra and help somebody who doesn't have enough. And that is exactly how the early church was encouraged to function, and they did function that way. But to say, well, then that would be like communism, is to miss an important point. Communism is a governmental system. And for a government to come to somebody who's earned more than I have earned and say, you've got to take some of what you've earned and give it to Steve Gregg because he hasn't earned as much as you have, that's not justice. That's an injustice. We might say, well, we're making that rich person be merciful. No, you're not. You're just taking his money. That's not being merciful. It's not merciful. There's no generosity in taking somebody else's money and giving it to someone else. It's not generous on the part of the one who's being forced to give his money, and it's not generous on the part of the government who forces it from him, because the government's not giving their money. It's giving someone else's money. They didn't earn it. They took it from someone who earned it. That's theft. So communism as a governmental system is unjust. It robs from the rich to give to the poor. And we might say, well, shouldn't Christianity like to see rich people, you know, share with the poor? Yes, voluntarily. If it's not voluntary, it's not done out of love. And whatever is not out of love is nothing. Remember, Paul said, if I took all my goods and bestowed them on the poor, but didn't have love, it's nothing. You know, so there's no virtue in being forced to share. It might be something that a government has, we might say, has the power to enforce, but it doesn't make it a just law. It's not a just system.
Wow. So communism is more like an enforced governmental practice upon the people, so they're forced to share, versus Christianity and Christ in the early church was more, it's more a community, a unity, but based on love and everybody having equality.
Yeah, all virtue in the Christian faith has got to be done out of love. Paul said that at the beginning of 1 Corinthians 13. If I prophesy, if I move mountains, no matter what I do, if I have all wisdom and all understand all mysteries, if I give my body to be burned and give my goods to the poor, he says, if I do any of that without love, it's nothing. So nothing that is done for motives other than love is truly Christian. Now, anytime a government comes along and says, you, whether you want to or not, have to do this charitable thing. Well, there's no love involved there. The government doesn't love the person who's stealing from, because if you love someone, you won't steal from them. And the person who's being stolen from isn't doing it out of love either. So it's just all bad.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense.
All right. Sure. All right.
I can share that with somebody. Can I ask one more thing?
Okay.
So around the time when the apostles were spirit-filled and they were out preaching, and there was more disciples, you know, wasn't there around, you know, there was the 12, and then wasn't there more?
Yeah.
Like 500 or so?
Yeah, all the believers were called disciples, yeah.
Right. How come you think there was no other writings of the other disciples who were, like, distributed after the persecution and stuff like that?
Well, I don't know how many of them did write. And then of those that did, I don't know how many of their works would have been expected to be preserved. It's amazing that we have any preserved writings from 2,000 years ago on any subject by any author, because to keep something in writing for the 1,500 years until the printing press was invented. See, once the printing press came along, you know, you can mass produce literature, but until then, every piece of literature had to be written by somebody with a pen in their hand. And so when old parchments begin to wear out, the easiest thing is just let them wear out, and then you lose that document, never see it again. But if someone says, no, I want that document to be saved, they'll copy it. But then when their copy gets old, somebody still has to want to see it saved badly enough to recopy that. And for something to be copied hundreds of times over thousands of years, means it's got to be very treasured. It's got to be something very valuable to people that in every generation someone wants to go to the trouble of copying it down and preserving it. Now, once the printing press came along, it became an easy matter. But like I said, it's amazing that we have any books survived from 2,000 right. years ago at all, given the way that they had to be preserved. Now, more than that, it's amazing that any of the apostles wrote books at all, because writing wasn't the thing it is today. Now, today we don't write as much. We type things out on our computers. But until the computer age, people, often wrote letters by hand and so forth. But we still do that. But we just go out and buy a big old ream of 500 pages of blank paper. And we go down and buy some ballpoint pens for, $2 for 10 of them, and so forth. And we can get a stamp for 50 cents or whatever it is and put it in an envelope. It's real easy to send mail and to write things now. Back then, you couldn't buy paper. You couldn't buy pens. You couldn't buy ink.
Yeah.
These things had to be manufactured for people who specialized in documentary. Think about it. Parchment that they wrote on, that was goat skin. They're writing on leather. How expensive would that be if we had to write everything on leather, So, I mean, the fact that these books got written at all is astonishing. It's not surprising that there weren't more. It's surprising that there weren't that many.
Was remembered by memory, too, right? Remember these things and then...
Right, yes. They passed a lot of things down by memory, which made it not as important to write them down. That's why the Gospels weren't really written until near the end of the apostles' lifetimes. They had spent 20, 30, 40 years preaching from memory what Jesus said, but they were about to die, and so they felt they better write it down just in case, some of this gets forgotten. And then the church, of course, valued what they wrote enough to keep copying it through the ages until it was finally possible to print it on a printing press. But it's astonishing that it survived at all. Now, there are other books besides the Bible that have survived as long, but not very many. And the ones that have, we don't have very many manuscripts of them that have survived, whereas we have 5,000 Greek manuscripts of the New Testament, which is amazing. That means a lot of people were copying it, a lot of people wanted it and valued it. All right?
Yeah, great. Thank you, Steve.
All right, Dee. Thanks for your call. Good talking to you. Let's talk to Evan from Sandy, Utah. Evan, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Yeah.
So, I promise I'll stop bothering you at some point. I've called quite a few times, but you're very instructive. So I hope that you know that. Thank you so much for everything
you
do. Well,
that's why we do this. That's why we do this. You're welcome to call. Yeah.
Oh, thank you. So, I am a recovering Mormon, and I'm coming out of my angry atheist phase.
Yeah.
So I asked a lot of elementary questions here, but I'm relearning. I was wondering if you would comment on the concept of the last days. As you can imagine, this is something that is very particular to me and from my background, Latter-day Saint and all that. I'm having trouble understanding how a concept of the last days can be applicable for, say, 2,000 years. I have trouble understanding what the statute of limitations on something like that, saying we're in the last days. And I'm wondering
if there's no shelf life on that phrase. Right, yeah. Well, let me just say, the last days has been understood three different ways, to my knowledge. That is the biblical phrase, the last days. One is very popular to say, well, we're living in the last days. And usually when people say that, they mean we're kind of at the end, of history. There's Jesus is going to come back before very long, and we don't know how long it'll be, but it's not very long. We're in the last days, basically, of history before the coming of Christ. And that's the most common way we hear that term in the Bible.
That's how I'm familiar with it, yeah.
Right, and that's, of course, what's meant in the term Latter-day Saints also, is that it means in the latter part of history. Now, there is another view out there, which Christians sometimes hold, and that is that the whole 2,000 years is the last days. And you mentioned that seems a little strange, and it does. It does seem strange. And the reason for it is because those who hold that opinion believe, well, they notice that all the New Testament writers said that they were living in the last days. Peter and Paul and James and John all mentioned they were living in the last times or the ends of the age or the last days or something like that. They use terms like that. And so many Christians say, wow, if they were living in the last days, and yet history has gone on this long, that's a really long last days. So this whole age of the church apparently is the last days. Now, I held that view for a while because I also noticed that the writers of Scripture said they were living in the last days. I thought, well, they were already in the last days, and we must still be in the last days, only the even the further laster last days. But it always seems strange to me to say it that way because, frankly, it seems like it should say last centuries or last times maybe or last era, the last age or something like that rather than last days, because days doesn't seem like it's talking about thousands of years. Now, I've come to a third view at this point, and I believe that when the New Testament writers spoke about living in the last days, they didn't mean the last days of history or the last phase of history or the last age before Jesus comes back. I believe they're referring to the last days of the Jewish order. The Old Testament prophets spoke of the coming of the Messiah and his kingdom, and in those prophets, they very often combined the coming of Christ and his kingdom with the destruction of the old order. Now, that old order was initiated by Moses at God's behest, and it was God ordained, but it had become so corrupt, and it fell so short of what God was hoping, you know, to bring in, that the Messiah would bring a new covenant and a new order. The old covenant and the old order would then be replaced. Now, Jesus did that. And so when Jesus brought in the new order, the disciples knew, well, the older order must be about ready to go, because the prophets said that both of these things are going to happen around the same time. And Jesus said, for example, when they asked him, when will the temple be destroyed? He said, well, it'll happen in this generation. Well, the end of the temple would be the end of the old order, the end of Judaism. So basically, I think all the early Christian writers in before 70 AD, see, 70 AD is when the temple was destroyed and the old order was, you know, no longer to be seen. I think that since they all wrote before that time, that they spoke of their time as being in the last days. They were living in the last days of the Jewish order of that era, because they knew the new order had come. And
so, in other words, the last days of the Old Testament, the dawning of the new covenant is
exactly
starting.
Exactly.
Okay. So I didn't mean to interrupt. I just wanted to make sure I was.
No, you got it right. You got it right. I appreciate that.
Well, and I have never heard that before. That makes so much more sense. I mean, not that the Bible needs to make sense to me personally. I mean, who am I? But that makes so much more sense to me because, you know, it just seems so odd for them, you know, to say, oh, well, we're last days for 2,000 years. When is this going to happen? That's, as I said, I'm kind of coming out of an angry atheist phase, and because that's how I always use it.
Well,
what's up with the Bible on this? How can we be in the last days for 2,000? But that makes so much more sense.
Yeah. Well, Evan, you are much too reasonable and too humble to be an angry atheist. So you must be recovering well.
Well, thank you. I won't go into it because you've got a lot of stuff that you've got to go into. But yeah.
It's a pleasure to hear from you. And you don't ever feel like you're imposing by calling. You're not. I always be glad to talk to you. And also, feel free, if you want to call sometime and talk about, you know, what made you an angry atheist when you were and what your issues were then, because even though you're coming out of that, it might be helpful for people who are still there to hear what you were thinking at the time, and we could discuss that. I'd be interested in hearing it.
Well, and
anyway,
if that's okay, in the next few weeks I will. I guess I'll just, you know, before I leave, I'll just say that, you're very helpful. I'm learning a whole lot more, and I'm beginning to come around on the Bible, in part because I've been reading the Quran, and it is a loathsome, horrible book.
Yeah, it's not like the Bible, is it? No.
Well, no, and it goes around, it has no focus, it can't make up its mind. One minute it likes Christians and Jews, one minute it hates it, one minute Allah can do everything, then the next minute Allah can do nothing, one minute I could do a miracle if I wanted to, and then another.
I hear you. Hey,
at least the Bhagavad Gita is well written, even if it doesn't make much sense. At least it's a nice poem.
Yeah.
I'm derailing your.
We could discuss those things sometime too, but that gets us another direction.
I apologize to your audience. I'm sorry.
Evan. Well, thanks for your call, brother.
Likewise. Thank you.
Good to hear from you. Bye.
Bye-bye.
All right. Let's talk to John from Portland. Hi, John. Welcome to the Narrow Path.
Hey, Steve. How you doing today?
Good.
Good, good. I'm with you. I don't think Evan needs to apologize. It's good hearing him call in. He's got
a
question.
Amen.
Yeah, so my question for you today is this. You and I were on the same page in our concerns and objections to inner healing.
Uh-huh.
My question would be this. Would you have any objections or pauses with entering and ministering side-by-side with someone that's involved with inner healing? For example, if I were serving at the school back in the school days, and if I were involved with an inner healing ministry, and, you know, if I had no idea about the history, I don't even know about the Sanfords, and all I know is this, I've ministered inner healing to people for a long time, it's been very fruitful, and I just think it's great. Would you have any hang-ups with that kind of a situation, someone serving at the school that's involved with inner healing?
Well, I would definitely have trouble with it, and I would probably have to sit. I would have to sit you down and tell you, you know, what you just mentioned that you would have been ignorant of. If you still felt you wanted to continue it, I'd encourage you to, you know, minister somewhere else. Yeah.
Okay. I was just kind of curious how you would deal with a situation like that.
Yeah. Well, as you know, the problem is that it does have its roots in really dark things, and I just wouldn't want that kind of compromise if I was running the school and had a staff member doing that. So, I mean, there's a number of things that I don't condemn Christians if they think they should do it, but I wouldn't want them to be doing it under my umbrella of ministry. Oh, there's some strange sounds. All right.
Sorry about that. Yeah.
All right. Okay, John. Good talking to you, bro.
All right. Well, hey, thanks for your thoughts on that, Steve. I appreciate it.
All right. God bless you. Okay, we're going to talk next to Nick from Minneapolis, Minnesota. Nick,
hey,
welcome
Steve,
to the... Hi.
Hey, Steve. Great to talk to you. I'm not listening to you guys live, so I guess I'm not up to par as to the conversations, but I've been listening to your series on Matthew that's on YouTube,
yeah,
and I'm really enjoying it. But I had one question regarding the Magi, and like I said, this probably isn't even a big deal, but in the series that you did on Matthew, you kind of posited the fact that, or the notion that they were Gentiles.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering specifically why you think that, and if it's plausible that they could have been maybe, you know, a remnant that was left over from the Babylonian exile, and that's maybe why they were searching for the Messiah in Israel.
Well, you know, it's interesting because somebody I know who used to call this program a lot once told me that he had done some research. I think he'd even written a thesis on the Magi, and that it was his view that they were a group of Jewish priests or something from, you know, Persia or somewhere like that. And so he held the view that they were Jewish. I can't find that confirmed by any of the scholars I read. It may be that that's a truth that's unknown to the scholarly world, but basically the Magi are, the term is known from secular history to belong to a group of, astrologers and, you know, guys who practiced magic, and they were, and wise men, philosophers in Persia. And, there was a Jewish remnant there. In fact, I think it would probably be the Jewish remnant in Persia that had influenced the Magi to expect the Messiah. Remember, Daniel had lived his last years in Persia some, you know, 600 years earlier or 500 years earlier. And, Daniel was a very influential man in Persia, very respected. He's, you know, especially after he was thrown in the lion's den and came out alive again, he really was honored. And so there could easily have been a group of Magi, Gentile Magi, who wanted to include what Daniel had written and what Daniel had taught in their studies. And Daniel had given the prophecy of the 70 weeks, which would point to the general time period that Jesus was born, and that might have informed them. That's a possibility. I think it's almost certain that the Magi would have had contact with Jewish thought and Jewish people in Persia. Now, some people think the Magi were from Arabia, and I guess that's a possibility, too. But I think it's more often thought that they came from Persia, and that's where there would be a lot of Jewish influence. So if they were Jews, then fine. But I think Magi generally were not Jewish, but were Persians.
Okay.
So, I mean, they could have been Jewish Magi, I guess, but we're not told. I think the implications, without being told, we should assume they're just ordinary Magi from the East, which would not be Jewish men, I think.
Well, sorry if I could interject for just a moment, too. I know in the series, you know, as you're kind of going through it, you were discussing that, you know, Matthew, although he's writing to a Jewish audience, he's in maybe sort of subtle ways trying to get the Jewish people to accept more Gentile influence or be more inclusive to the Gentiles as they come into the church. Is that correct in understanding?
Yes, at least to recognize that Gentiles have recognized the Messiah, too, even earlier than the Jews did. Remember, in Matthew chapter 8, the Gentile centurion, when he shows that great faith, Jesus says, I haven't found that kind of faith in all of Israel. So here we have a story of a Gentile who exhibits faith so much that Jesus said, I haven't found a Jew with that kind of faith. I haven't found that in Israel. I have to get this from this Gentile. And those kinds of stories in Matthew do kind of, they're kind of a rebuke to the exclusivity of the Jewish thinking that would exclude Gentiles.
Okay, perfect. Well, Steve, I really appreciate it. Just so you know, we love you. Me and a couple of my friends, we try and listen to you all the time, listen to your debates. And we live in Minnesota, obviously, and sometime we'd like to fly out and hear you teach live. So we really appreciate what you're doing and keep up the good work.
Well, you could do it that way, or I could fly out to you and you could have a meeting there. You'd have to organize that.
Just don't do it in the winter.
Yeah, I know.
All right, Steve, God bless, and thank you so much.
Thank you, Nick. God bless you, too. Good talking to you. All right, Wendy from Esparto, California, it says. Hello, Wendy.
Hello, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
I know we don't have much time. I listen to you all the time, and I love your podcast. My specific question is, what do you say to people who say, why do I need a piece of paper to get married?
Well, I don't know that you need a piece of paper to get married, but it doesn't hurt. If they mean, why do I need the courthouse to recognize my marriage? Why do I need a legal document? I'm not sure people do. In biblical times, they didn't. But if you want to have the courts enforce your rights as a married couple, and protect the property rights and things like that, then usually that would require that the courts recognize your marriage. Morally speaking, I think that in the Bible, marriages were basically contracted between families. Usually the bride's family and the bridegroom's family, it was a family affair, not a state affair. And likewise, in early church, I believe people were married by the church, but not by Caesar, you know. That wasn't Caesar's domain. But I don't think it matters, but I think it can make a difference. Some people may want some of the benefits that come from being legally married in that way. So that would be my short answer. I wish I had more time to give a longer answer. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg. We are listener-supported. If you'd like to help us pay the radio bills, you can write to the Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730. Temecula, California, 92593. You can also donate from the website if you want to. That's thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us. Have a good weekend, and let's talk again Monday.